From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA TV senior analyst Jeffrey Young. Our topic on this edition of the program, an update on the political turmoil in Algeria and Libya. Our special guest, Thomas Hill. He's senior program officer for North Africa at the United States Institute of Peace, or USIP. Prior to his post at USIP, Thomas Hill was a senior professional staff member on the House of Representatives Committee on Foreign Affairs, where he specialized in North Africa. In addition, he served as foreign affairs officer in the Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs at the Department of State for 10 years, serving in several domestic and overseas assignments. Thomas Hill has written extensively also about ways to modernize the Department of State. However, our focus will be on Algeria and Libya. We were at these microphones discussing Algeria in April, immediately after Algerian strongman Abdelaziz Bouteflika resigned following weeks of mass protests. Since then, Algeria's protest movement has continued to maintain pressure on the army, which is overseeing a 90-day transitional period. Elections were scheduled for July 4, but have been postponed indefinitely. Meantime, peaceful demonstrations have resulted in significant achievements thus far. President Bouteflika resigned. Two former prime ministers and eight cabinet ministers are being prosecuted for corruption, and major business leaders have been arrested, as have the president's brother and two former intelligence chiefs. In Libya, despite the popular movement that challenged and ultimately overthrew Muammar Gaddafi in 2011, with the support of the United Nations and aid of NATO forces, the country remains unstable and fragmented. Following Gaddafi's death in October 2011, all states that participated in the NATO alliance intervention publicly pledged to support the United Nations and its mandate to facilitate Libya's transition. Unfortunately, since 2011, external actors continued to provide military and financial support to their Libyan proxies in contravention of UN Security Council resolutions. In December 2015, the Libya political agreement was signed in Morocco, which committed all parties to a unified governance structure under a Government of National Accord, or GNA. However, in a sign of how things have deteriorated, in April this year, General Khalifa Haftar, who refuses to recognize the UN-backed government in Tripoli, launched an assault on Tripoli and the internationally recognized Libyan leadership. The UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt have provided both military and political support to General Haftar, even as they publicly recognize the GNA. Well, we'll discuss with Thomas Hill the status of the democracy movement in Algeria and the very complicated geopolitical and military turmoil in Libya, as well as ramifications for the region. And Thomas Hill joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And as always, I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Jeffrey Young.
Glad to be here.
Thomas Hill, let's start with Algeria. I'd like you to give us a status update. Although longtime President Bouteflika resigned in April, Algeria's protests have continued unabated. What's the reason for the current standoff between protesters and the interim government?
So we're now approaching the 19th Friday of popular protests in the streets. It seems pretty clear that the people are demanding a complete overhaul of the system. You are seeing signs, the chants from the protesters call for not only the ouster of the president and the prime minister, but also Gayed Salah, who's the head of the military. And even though he's not nominally the leader of the current government, he is de facto the head of the current government. So the number of arrests that you pointed to, many of which are high-profile businessmen and politicians, some of whom are known to be complicit in corruption, that has not assuaged the concerns of the street. And at this point, the street seems to can only be pacified by a complete overhaul of the system.
This General Salah was on the side of the protesters and they saw him as their ally. So what happened between the protesters and General Salah?
So General Salah was and has been an intimate ally of President Bouteflika for decades. All major generals, all high-ranking generals in the Algerian military were handpicked by what we call le pouvoir, or the power, or le système, which is the group of people that were really running the country. When Salah switched sides, it was opportunism. This was not a change of heart or a change of philosophy. I think it was motivated by self-preservation. And now that he is still de facto running the country, people identify him as a remnant of the Bouteflika era, which he is. And he's also close to 80 years old, which also plays into this because many of the people who have been in power have been there since the independence effort from France, and they are seen as outdated, too old, past their prime, and he's a reflection of that era.
Well, just quickly, one more follow-up. Can you characterize the protests and the protesters? How broad of a cross-section of Algeria are they? Do they represent, again, a fairly broad cross-section, or are they mostly students? How would you characterize them, both in Algiers and throughout the country?
It's hard to say exactly who is inside the protest movement. As you well know, Algeria has largely been a black box to many in the West, and so our ability to see into the protest movement is limited. According to social media, it looks like it is a very broad cross-section of Algerian society. You see old people, you see young people. It does have, in many ways, not only is it a political movement, but it does seem to have a flavor of enthusiasm and joy and fun and kind of a circus element to it. So there are a lot of young kids who come out. Vendors have their carts with food stalls, etc. So people are participating in the protests not out of pure anger exclusively, although that element exists. So you do see a lot of different Algerians there. You also see flags from lots of different ethnic groups being flown, and that recently became a point of contention for General Salah, who criticized Algerians who were waving flags of ethnic minority groups. So it's not clear to what extent these subgroups are protesting for specific rights that are limited to their own objectives or a more broad national plan.
All right. Well, one thing is very clear. In a country that has been deprived of the ability to freely assemble and have a voice because of the closed system and the lack of free press, this is really a very significant moment. Now a question from my colleague, Jeffrey Young.
You know, Mr. Hill, in most countries, especially countries that are led, let's say, with a bit of force, control of the country, maintenance of the regime is a matter of keeping control of the security apparatus. In Algeria right now, how much control does Salah have on the state security apparatus? Does he have complete control? Is it breaking away from him? Is it getting away from him? What's the status of that?
Right now, it appears that he still maintains absolute control over the military and military forces. The military has been a central element to the regime for decades and is a really insular organization. They take care of themselves, and they have benefited from the system that exists through corruption and patronage and other elements. So there are a lot of generals and high-ranking officials within the military who stand to lose a lot if things change. And thus far, I think it's important to point out that of all the high-profile people who've been arrested and imprisoned or brought in for questioning, none of them have been generals. So it does seem that General Salah still maintains an element of control, and I think the real question is, at what point does he lose his patience?
Does the opposition have a leader?
The opposition does not have a leader, and I don't know if that's a product of the times we live in with social media being what it is, but there are some figures who seem to have a larger following than others, but there is by no means a declared opposition leader. And in some ways, based on what the street seems to be calling for, I would wonder whether or not, were someone to identify themselves as leader of the opposition and engage in direct dialogue with the government, whether that wouldn't make them a polarizing figure, whether it wouldn't identify them as a traitor to the cause.
Why were elections postponed?
So the elections were by law going to happen on July 4th, as you pointed out, but the postponement was because the street had demanded that the elections be postponed, because for the last 20 years, the political parties that have existed at the permission of the Bouteflika regime. And so they're all perceived as co-opted by the former elements of the regime. So there isn't an opposition party, a truly opposition party. It doesn't have the grassroots reached in order to mount a successful national campaign. So the opposition, the people in the streets, clearly did not want to allow election to go forward when the field was so heavily tilted in favor of existing parties who were aligned or benefited from the prior system.
With respect to the demands of the opposition that elections aren't really sufficient, what they want is an overhaul of le système, of the entire economic political system. How realistic is that? And could they be mollified with something less, more evolutionary or incremental?
My impression is that they will not be satisfied with less than a massive change. I think the fact that the opposition was able to win some significant concessions from the ruling group or le pouvoir early on has only added fuel to the fire. It has not slowed down the momentum. So the fact that Bouteflika resigned and then his brother gets thrown in jail or gets arrested, all of these things only fed the fuel that if you come to the streets and if you protest, you will get what your demands are. Thus far, these protests have only gone on for 19 weeks, and they've achieved a lot. I mean, the idea that all these people have been arrested, this would have been unthinkable 2 years ago.
Right. But do they risk overplaying their hand, in your view, Thomas?
It's certainly a possibility. I mean, at some point, Guy Atsala, the general who is really running things for the government right now, at some point, the protesters will threaten his existence. And what you can make the argument they are threatening it now, but that they will continue to apply pressure, which will impact either his personal wealth or the wealth and benefits of his friends and family, et cetera. And then it becomes a question of how much of that is he willing to withstand before he unleashes the military in a more violent fashion.
I understand from reading reports that both the protest movement and an association of trade unions have called for a maximum one-year political transition overseen by new and independent interim institutions such as, what, technocrats? Who would be this interim institution that they're talking about?
I don't think it's a plan that's been well vetted or been necessarily received feedback from the people who are actually out in the streets. Certainly, the institutions that exist in Algeria are weak. And so to assume that any one institution or any amalgamation of institutions could somehow assume control, I think that would be very optimistic.
Do we get into these situations where we declare governments of unity and you have elements of both sides and you put them together and just let it spin in the blender for a little while and see if it works?
No, because in this instance, what the people are protesting against is really a understanding of what the state-populist relationship should be. In Algeria, you've had a state that really has been parasitic to the natural resources that exist there and has really tilted the game in its own favor. And so the idea that somehow you could tinker with it or just recalibrate, I think, is not compatible with what's happened in Algeria. The Algerian system would have to be completely flipped on its head if you wanted to see the type of reform that the street demands.
Before we go to a break, Thomas, one more question on Algeria. Do you think, in fact, this resignation of Bouteflika and all of the successes that the movement has had thus far, can it lead to this real fundamental change that the Algerian street, the protesters, the vast majority of the population are seeking?
I would break that question into smaller pieces. So can they achieve the goal of pushing out many of the personalities who are identified with the old guard? I believe they can. Can they then turn that success into a functioning government? I have my doubts. The fact that the opposition is not cohesive, it doesn't have a leader right now, that their only platform item seems to be throw out the old guys. They're not proposing a new idea or a new way forward. That leads me to think that it could be pretty rocky instituting whatever form of government comes next. And unless there are some really smart people who can step forward with some proposals about how Algeria could transition from the very statist economy to a more open and inclusive economy and political system, I think it's going to be messy.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Thomas Hill. He's the Senior Program Officer for North Africa at the United States Institute of Peace. I'm Carol Castiel, along with my colleague, VOA TV Senior Analyst Jeffrey Young. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal Twitter fan, Jeremiah Msomba from Tanzania. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Well, back to our show and back to our special guest, Thomas Hill. Let's turn now to Libya. Wow, what a complicated situation. I wonder if you could just bring us up to date with regard to where things stand, General Haftar, the government, the official government, and so forth.
At the end of March of this year, it looked like the head of the internationally recognized government in Tripoli, Fayez al-Sarraj, was going to meet with his counterpart and warlord, General Khalifa Haftar, and he represents the Libyan National Army, at a peace conference, or what they called a national conference, in the Libyan city of Gdamse. It was supposed to take place in mid-April. It was going to be hosted by the United Nations. The UN Secretary General flew in to Libya in order to promote it. It was an important step, albeit perhaps a small step, but an important step nonetheless towards resolving the conflict. Within hours of the Secretary General touching down in Libya, General Khalifa Haftar launched an offensive on the capital of Tripoli, effectively killing the national conference idea and throwing the prospects for a peace settlement into the garbage. So I guess we're now in the eighth week. We're at a stalemate where the LNA forces that support General Haftar are encamped outside of Tripoli, and a collection of militias and armed forces that are loyal to the GNA and other forces that just are anti-Haftar, a mosaic of kind of bad actors plus good actors, have aligned to defend the city. And it looks like we're in for a pretty long stalemate.
UN Secretary General Guterres, when he came to Libya, he said emphatically that the arms embargo must be enforced. But obviously, the Libyan National Army is well-provisioned, well-equipped, and well-driven. So please explain to people, how is it possible for this non-state entity, the LNA, to have all this equipment, have all these logistics, have the money, etc.? What's going on? Who is funding them? Who is propelling this?
The Libyan National Army and General Khalifa Haftar have aligned themselves, or I guess you could say he's been chosen by the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia and Egypt as their champion. He's the horse they're backing in this race. More recently, the French have also seemed to show a preference for General Khalifa Haftar, which has been a problem. The Emirates in particular, but also Egypt, have provided money, weapons to Khalifa Haftar, as have the Russians provided funding. So Haftar has a diverse set of backers who are all using him to advance their own objectives inside the country. And he has found a way to turn that into a moderately effective military that is now sacking the capital.
Why are they banking on him? What is it about Khalifa Haftar that wants them to put their money on the betting line?
What Khalifa Haftar claims to represent, and I say claim because I think what he claims is not what he actually is, but his claim is that he will clean out all of the Islamists and anybody who appears to be something like a Muslim Brotherhood or anything that might look like democracy. So he is the warlord, the strong man who will come in and impose rule of law, and his style of governing will look somewhat like President Sisi in Egypt, and they like that. That is the type of government that they're comfortable with in the Middle East. It's not a threat to them the way Tunisia is as a democracy. It's not a threat to them the way an Islamist government would be prior to the Sisi takeover in Egypt with Morsi. So he has promised to deliver these things. I think the real question is, are these claims, or is he actually in bed with some of the figures he claims to want to destroy?
And what about all the bad actors that are in Libya? There's so many people that exit Libya and come down through Mali and infect West Africa. This has been a major problem. And if Haftar took control of the country, what about all of these bad actors and insurgent elements? Are he going to wipe them all out? Are they all going to be under control? Is this going to be, to use an expression sarcastically, peace through strength, meaning the fist?
So that's certainly his claim, and that's why he thinks that the international community should back him. The reality is that within his LNA forces, there are many actors that if you had a spectrum and you were to put bad guys at one end, put ISIS in that corner of bad guys and Ansar al-Sharia and other terrorist organizations, there are some groups within the LNA that you would also put in that category. So I don't think it's credible for him to say that he is going to be this bulwark against radical Islam or violent terrorism coming up across the Sahel and Maghreb. Even if he were to take control, as you propose, his forces are not capable of exercising authority throughout the entire country. The South would still be porous and would still be roughshod with all of these bad actors. So I think he's offering fool's gold here.
Now let's go to the possibility of resolution through election. Fayez al-Sarraj not too long ago said, here's how we solve it. Let's have an election. Maybe he wins. Maybe I win. Let's see who wins. Well, losers have consequences, and so do winners. And in this sort of a situation, why should Haftar even go for an election when he can just win the whole game?
Yeah, the proposition of having elections is a Hail Mary. The reality is that the country is so violent right now and so unstable that there would be no way to hold elections that would be considered credible and free and fair or inclusive. Haftar has no incentive to go to elections. He controls 70% of the country already.
70%?
That's my guesstimate of the amount of landmass he controls. He controls enormous swaths of it. Sarraj is been pinned into a corner here inside Tripoli. I think he is desperate to find a way out. Offering up elections makes him appear to have some kind of control or some kind of leverage here. But politically speaking, Sarraj is deeply, deeply weakened by what's happened.
Now, who controls the petrol resources right now in Libya? Who has the money in their pocket?
So the money actually is controlled by the people in Tripoli, the Government of National Accord, GNA. But the oil fields, many of which are in the south, are, and some are in the east, are controlled by people who claim to be loyal to Haftar. Now, the problem is oil can only be sold legally out through certain channels that have been approved by the United Nations, and all those are the ones that are controlled by the GNA. So even though Haftar may control some of the land that includes some of these resources, his ability to sell them on the open market would be quite difficult. So the money, actually, is one of the reasons why Sarraj still has a fighting chance, is because in theory, he could cripple the banking system in the east by withholding lines of credit and the money that is accrued through these oil revenues, which would effectively destroy the economy in the east. But that obviously would have knock-on effects that would hurt people that are not necessarily part of Haftar's group.
I have a very basic question. Why is it that the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and even France, why did they not support the internationally recognized government to begin with, or only paid lip service to it? What is it about Haftar?
So Haftar uses the language of a strong man and offers the Gulf states, or what he claims to offer them, is the opportunity to instill rule of law through strength, and that this will not turn into a situation where you have elections where, God forbid, in their mind, an Islamist or moderate Islamist government comes to power and somehow they align themselves with Turkey or Qatar or one of these other countries that they so detest. So for them, it's about putting in their guy. And while the international community put pressure on every member state to support the UN-backed government in Tripoli, quietly, and I guess you could say now, not so quietly, they've supported Haftar all along.
Okay, but there's no reason to believe that Prime Minister Fayez Sarraj has any use for the hardline Islamist.
No, he himself is from the east. He was chosen because he was perceived to be somebody that everybody could kind of work with. So he himself is not an Islamist. He does not represent Islamists. The fear is that in a free and fair election format, some percentage of seats or some part of the population would push in groups that would be perceived as Islamists or supporters of violent extremism. And that's what Fayez is pushing. He's pushing democracy. What you have on the other side is Haftar saying openly, Libya is not ready for democracy. He's not even making a claim that he will, if he takes over the country, turn it into a democracy. So it's really a choice between those two kind of extremes.
So we got rid of one strong man, Muammar Gaddafi, only to maybe put in another strong man like Haftar.
Yeah, and it would seem to me, based on the way things have gone so far, that Haftar does not have the ability to control the population to the same degree that Gaddafi did. And so even were he to take over, if you believe Gaddafi's Libya was a stable state, this will be less stable.
What is the U.S. position vis-a-vis Libya?
So publicly, the U.S. position remains that we support the UN-backed government in Tripoli, but there was much discussion about a phone call that occurred in the middle of April between President Trump and General Khalifa Haftar. The suspicion is that that phone call came about based on a conversation either with President Sisi in Egypt and the Emiratis or both, both of whom obviously support Haftar, and that they prodded Trump to make this phone call. Subsequent to the phone call, there's been no indication that U.S. policy has changed. The White House put out an explanatory statement saying that they still supported a peaceful solution. So I don't know that the policy has changed, although the phone call with Haftar raised a lot of questions, and many in the international community were surprised and felt like that was not helpful.
And why do the French support Field Marshal Haftar over Sarraj?
So the French position is fairly agnostic as to individuals in the political spectrum. Their interest is on stopping illegal immigration. So whichever candidate or person or entity offers them the ability or offers them the promise of stopping illegal immigration into France, that's who they're going to back. And they believe right now that Haftar, or at least they did up until recently, that Haftar was the most likely person to be able to control Libya's borders. And so for them, that's all that matters.
Could there be yet another civil war?
Yeah, I think this is that civil war. Yeah, what's going on right now, I think.
No, but after, let's say hypothetically that Haftar does succeed in taking Tripoli and essentially ends al-Sarraj and his government. Once Haftar has control of the country, there's still a lot of other elements that aren't necessarily part of LNA and aren't necessarily signed on to Haftar. And don't they just pick up arms and say, well, we're going to carve out this space for ourselves? We start turning Libya into a collection of stands?
It took General Haftar 3 years to take Benghazi, and at great toll to the local population and the infrastructure, it would take at least that long for him to take Tripoli. The humanitarian cost would be extreme. Were he to take Tripoli and still have the capacity to continue to fight, I would suspect that he would then turn against some of the other cities that were opposed to him all along. That would include Misrata in particular. So turning on Misrata, the city of Misrata, would bring him into conflict with a very well-armed group, which again would mean he'd have to lay siege. The humanitarian toll would be outstanding. So you could see bloodshed leading to significant more bloodshed before this ever gets, quote unquote, resolved.
And who stops it?
Who stops it? You'd like to think that the Libyan people say enough is enough and that they pull back on their leadership and their sons and daughters who are engaged. But it's a country of only 7 million people. So I don't know what the level of violence they're willing to accept and how much damage they're willing to inflict upon their own country.
Given the weakness or fragility of the United Nations or the lack of mandate to be more forceful, you say in your testimony on Capitol Hill that absent U.S. leadership to corral the internal and external actors operating inside of Libya today, that it's unlikely that the standoff between Haftar and the anti-Haftar forces in Tripoli can be resolved without significant cost to unarmed civilian population. How much stock do you put in that? I mean, do you even see the prospect of U.S. leadership, given what you just said about President Trump and what he says publicly and perhaps privately?
I think I was more optimistic about the possibility of U.S. engagement about a month ago or so. I think the escalation in tensions in the Gulf with Iran have distracted the White House or focused their attention, you could say, more on the Gulf. Libya, if it was ever on their radar, is now a distant piece of that. And now more than ever, the White House is going to want to keep countries like the Emirates, Saudi Arabia, on board with their position. And so going against them in Libya would seem contrary to what they're focused on in Iran. So I think it's incredibly unlikely now that the White House would get involved in Libya if it was ever a possibility before.
Well, let's briefly, before we close, Thomas, look at the ramifications both of Algeria's movement and in Libya. First, Libya, the ramifications can only be very dire for the region if we continue in this stalemate. Talk about that and what's at stake.
Yeah, so the first-line victims are obviously the Libyan people who are suffering tremendous hardships. The violence has devastated the infrastructure, including the electrical grid. I've heard recent reports about cuts to water supply, the number of kids that are out of school because of violence. I mean, all of these knock-on effects of violence are just having a devastating effect on the Libyan people and the Libyan economy, which is a country that should be fairly well off. Then you have all of the violence and misery that goes along with the illegal transfer of people, weapons, goods through Libya to other parts of the region. The fact that you have an ungoverned space in Libya, or parts of it are ungoverned, allows terrorist organizations and other bad actors, many of whom are criminals and criminal elements, to exploit that for their own benefit. And the locals, again, here are the ones who are most impacted by that. But the transfer of migrants from the Sahel and even further south through Libya, their road to Europe is very difficult, and many do not make it along the way. Many women find themselves into forced prostitution. Many men and women find themselves into forced forms of slavery. It is a horrible, horrible outcome to see Libya as it is, which is a basket case.
Well, my takeaway is that notwithstanding this desire for freedom, for democracy, and for reconciliation in the case of Libya, we're seeing the forces of authoritarianism, whether it's from the UAE or Saudi Arabia or Egypt, they're still very strong and they're trying to thwart or combat these movements, which is unfortunate.
It is unfortunate. It's not inconsistent with the positions that those countries have taken in the past. I think they see it as an opportunity to exert their foreign policy while other countries that have traditionally been engaged in the Middle East and tried to advance counter narratives or counter agendas of pro-democracy are removed or trying to remove themselves. And if this is the new normal where countries in the Gulf are going to export their foreign policy across the region, I think that doesn't bode well for U.S. national security interests.
Thomas Hill is the Senior Program Officer for North Africa at the United States Institute of Peace. Thomas, thank you so much for your critical insights on Algeria and Libya. We greatly enjoyed it.
Thanks for having me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guest. Our engineer was Vasco Volorich. Joining me on the program was Jeffrey Young, VOA TV senior analyst. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.